Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast, your source for current issues within the legal practice. Today, the Federalist Society's Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group is hosting a discussion by Nicholas Wapshot on his recent book, Keynes-Hayek, The Clash That Defines Modern Economics. Mr. Wapshot, who is a former senior editor at the London Times and at the New York Sun, is also the author of Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, A Political Marriage. Joining us and participating in today's discussion is Mr. James Haynes, who serves in the leadership of both our Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group Executive Committee and our Baltimore Lawyers Chapter. Mr. Haynes has had an active trial and appellate practice and volunteers at several Washington, D.C. area law schools, judging moot court competitions. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. I'm David Ray, Practice Group Associate Director for the Federalist Society, and I'm now pleased to welcome our podcasters, Nicholas Wapshot and James Haynes. Mr. Wapshot's book examines the vastly divergent economic philosophies of John Maynard Keynes and Friedrich von Hayek. Messrs. Keynes and Hayek studied the normal course of the capitalist business cycle, especially after the end of the First World War, but reached radically different opinions about the role government should play in regulating and ameliorating the effects of the business cycle. These two gentlemen participated in ongoing debates about the respective merits of their own philosophies and the demerits of the other's philosophies. Mr. Wapshot examines these debates and expounds on them today. He will be interviewed by James Haynes, and I now turn the program over to Jim Haynes.
Thank you, David, and welcome, Mr. Wapshot. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Jim.
A book about two long-dead European economists and their personal and intellectual relationship seems like an odd subject for a book aimed at a wide popular audience. But you go even further. You say that the United States is headed in 2012 for a Keynes versus Hayek presidential election. Would you explain the connection there?
Yes, I think that the battle between these two great men 80 years ago was vituperative and interesting and would have been purely a matter of a footnote in economic history had they come to some sort of conclusion. But in fact, they'd never quite punched each other out of the ring. And the result is they left a scar, or they left a noticeable gap in the discussion about the role of government in the economy, which has continued on and off for the last 8 years and came sharply into focus in the events of 2008 and 2009 when the financial industry froze up and when government felt obliged to step in order to get the country's economy moving again. And then also at the beginning of 2009, when a very large stimulus bill of nearly $1 trillion was injected into the American economy in order, in traditional Keynesian way, to boost the economy and get people, get economic growth resumed again. And that's why I say that in a way, everything since the end of World War II in economics has been more or less Keynesian, including the monetarist revolution of Milton Friedman. He stayed still within the parameters of what Keynes had invented, which turned out to be macroeconomics in the 30s. From the mid-70s onwards, there was an increasing chorus of people of disapproval saying that Keynes had led all Western economies into a morass, which only a sharp reduction in the size of the state would be able to cure. And that came absolutely into the spotlight at the end of 2008, 2009, when the word Keynes, that had been forgotten probably for 30 years or more outside of the economics profession, became the byword in what the government was doing, and instantly, or near instantly, there was buyer's remorse for borrowing all of this money and spending all this money, and the word Hayek entered the vocabulary. Very often the words Keynesian and Hayekian are never explained in newspapers, but I went back to the original debate to find out what it was about, and to my happy surprise, I must say that I did know it, so it wasn't so much of a surprise, I discovered that it was for a storyteller like me, a biographer like me, it was really an interesting and intriguing division that would actually cast a very interesting light on what we are currently experiencing, and as we come towards, in the next 12 months, come towards the next general election here, the presidential rivalries will be between those on the one side. The candidate will be Obama, who has suggested a $500 billion extra stimulus into the economy, which is a traditional Keynesian way of increasing demand, and the other side, whoever it will be when they've finished their endless debates, and whoever is chosen, will be recommending a much smaller government per se, and that's the Hayekian solution to the morass that that people on probably on both sides now feel the economy's got into.
Well, to go back perhaps to the source of your book for a moment, was there a moment of inspiration for you when you decided that the interest and value of this subject matter warranted a book? It's an unusual subject. I can't think of too many others that I've seen.
Yes. It's true to say that this has been in the back of my mind for a long time. I was taught by two non-Keynesian economists, Peacock and Wiseman, at the University of York in the early 70s, at a time when stagflation was taking hold in the Western world. And they pointed out to me that there was indeed an alternative to straight Keynesianism, and that it could be found in the works of Friedrich Hayek. So I knew that there was an alternative to Keynes. Then, as I became a journalist and as I started working in the political field and reporting politics, I was just coincided, my interest in politics coincided with the rise of Margaret Thatcher. And she was someone who had read Hayek, and she really set her sights by the world of and ideas of Friedrich Hayek. Indeed, there are many examples of her coming into a meeting and whipping out a volume of Friedrich Hayek, slamming it on the table and saying, "That's what we believe." She introduced for the first time to the Conservative Party, which until then was a very pragmatic party, was only interested in really getting elected or re-elected. Margaret Thatcher introduced an interesting ideological vein through Friedrich Hayek, and that, of course, because in the mid-70s is when I began my journalistic career, and then Margaret Thatcher was elected and then stayed as Prime Minister for 13 years, and I was the political correspondent of the London Observer and watched her at very close quarters, and since most days I would go into Downing Street and I would talk with the very people who had set Thatcher out on this Hayekian road. So for me it was a natural sort of subject. When I came here to live in America 10 years ago, I was looking around for a subject and discovered, of course, that Ronald Reagan too had read Hayek, and he and Thatcher were joined together in their common understanding of the value of Hayek in trying to address economic issues. Hayek, it should be said, thought neither Thatcher nor Reagan were particularly good Hayekians, but he gave them some credit for at least moving in the right direction. So when the events of 2008-2009 took place and the words Keynesian and Hayekian started appearing without any explanation in newspapers, I said to my agent, I would like to write a book about, write a book about Keynes, a fascinating figure. I mean, outside of Winston Churchill, probably the greatest Englishman of the 20th century, constantly inventive and extraordinary, a massive intellect. And he said, "Well, you can't, because there are too many books about Keynes about. But if you can find a small element of the Keynes story which would be pertinent for today," and I said, "Well, as it happens, there is one, and that is that no one remembers that right back in the early 30s, he fought with Friedrich Hayek in London. There was a great battle between Keynes at King's Cambridge and Hayek at the London School of Economics, and that actually caused the definition of the what became to be known as a clear political divide between fiscal conservatism and liberal Keynesianism. And so for me, it was a natural thing to do. I knew the story was there, and when I actually went through all the dusty old notes and the learned journals and so on, and where this story's been buried for 80 years, I was thrilled to discover really quite how vituperative and nasty the debate was between the two of them. They took their gloves off pretty early in the debate. And in a way, it's the viciousness of that original debate, in a way, I think, which explains some of the sharpness of the debate and the irreconcilable differences between left and right today.
Now, reading the book, one senses that intellectual and personal relationships between Hayek and Keynes are really inseparable. And certainly you balance them. You refer to one and then the other in your book. I'm interested in your thoughts as a journalist and as a biographer, a historian. How did you decide to strike the balance between writing a book that perhaps emphasized the emotional aspect of it at the expense of the rational and the logical, or vice versa? How did you balance the two, presenting Keynes and Hayek as personalities, as living individuals, as well as sort of the exemplars of different economic philosophies?
Yes, well, as a journalist, I've always thought that the best way of explaining dry concepts is through individuals. And so always I'm looking for a way of personifying a story. Sometimes it's more appropriate than not. In this case, it was very clear that the two characters I was dealing with did, in the way they lived their lives, express the difference of approach between John Maynard Keynes, for instance, was someone who was brought up with very much he was very privileged. He had a strong sense of noblesse oblige. He went to Eton and Cambridge, which either Eton and Cambridge or Eton or Oxford are the traditional schooling of the ruling class. And he inherited a lot of that aristocratic notion about how you should look after people if you've been so blessed with material and social benefits in your own life. He was therefore concerned about unemployment, above everything, and not least the persistent unemployment throughout the 20s that had been caused by fixing the pound at the too high a level, at the pre-war, pre-Great War level. Hayek was a different sort of creature altogether, and in his own way, fascinating to me. He was very much a buttoned-up Austrian. I mean, literally buttoned up. Those sort of tweed coats that he wore with the velvet collars had all three buttons done up at the front. He was someone, however, who really started off as a social democrat. In fact, he started off as a rather sort of well-meaning, soft-hearted person. But thanks to reading Ludwig von Mises' books on socialism, he came to the conclusion that it was an inappropriate means of making life more benign, more friendly to people who didn't have anything. And of course, also, he had, through his own personal experience, seen the way that his own family, who had done nothing wrong in their lives, they had been good Austrian bourgeois citizens. They had behaved properly, they were impeccably well-mannered and so on, they'd saved when they needed to save and so on. And yet at the end of World War I, they found themselves impoverished, sitting shivering in their palatial apartments, unable to put an extra knob of coal or a log of wood onto the fire because they couldn't afford it. Because inflation in the post-war Austrian economy had taken off. If you remember all of those stories, which are totally apocryphal in our minds, they were true about people going to work and coming back with a wheelbarrow load of money because overnight another zero or two zeros had been added onto the currency. Hayek described how in Austria, in Vienna, he heard the government printing presses night and day printing extra money in order to try to keep up with the insatiable inflation that had overtaken them. And that misery made him a lifelong defender of sound money and someone who was terrified of inflation taking hold. And so from those two very personal experiences in the beginning, there were two great characters that set themselves at different ends of policy problems to solve, one unemployment, the other inflation. And what happened in the early 30s was extraordinary because Keynes was making great progress trying to convince people that if a government could intervene and could increase demand and therefore could put people back to work, then it should. It had a moral duty to do that. And he was making some good ground anyway with his argument. But a new professor, Lionel Robbins of economics at the London School of Economics, rare for an Englishman at any time, but rare certainly for those times, actually read German and had read Austrian economics. And he said there is a totally contradictory argument, which is entirely plausible, against what Keynes is talking about. And that can be found in the School of Austrian Economics. And what would enhance his own reputation as a new professor, but also the reputation of the London School of Economics altogether, would be to counter Keynes. And so he sent for Hayek, and he got him to give four lectures, which transformed the landscape in Britain, because for once, King's Cambridge found that it had a rival, and a very articulate rival, in Hayek. I could go on endlessly about this, but the two men were absolutely pivotal. You can't imagine that the Keynesian economy, the notion of macroeconomics as we know today, looking at an economy from the top down, would ever have been, or would have been discovered this quickly anyway, had it not been for the wealth of intellect that Keynes was able to throw at this problem, which meant that very fast during the 30s, he found to his own satisfaction anyway, an intellectual justification for government intervention. And on this, at the same time, you had someone who was so resolute in his belief that inflation was totally demeaning and would lead to sinister forces operating in society in terms of Hayek. And the fact they both not only lived together in the same city, as it were, but they were able to meet and talk and fight with each other intellectually, for a biography, it's a complete gift.
Now, good books tend to have good beginnings, and I was struck when that you opened your book with the image of Hayek and Keynes both on the roof of King's Chapel during World War II. And I wonder if you could expand on that, because I, in a way that encapsulates the kind of odd relationship that they had.
That's right. They're what teenage girls today would call frenemies, I think. Friendly enemies. They intellectually, they were directly opposed to each other, and Keynes, for the whole of his life, really didn't give much time to Hayek's ideas, but they did become friendly. Keynes was an extraordinarily generous person in almost all respects. First of all, he could never turn down a battle or a fight, which is why when Hayek arrived in London, he actually gave him time. He actually arrived first in 1928 for a brief meeting, and they fell out instantly, and they started fighting instantly. But Hayek's memory of it was how extraordinary it was that he was an unknown person. He was meeting the mighty Keynes for the first time, and that Keynes, instead of sort of turning on his heel and walking out of the room, turned and addressed his concerns and triggered a debate which then would last, well, at least 8 years, might go on for another 8 years, perhaps. And Keynes's generosity was shown again in 1940 when the London School of Economics, which is on the Strand in London, straddling the street that links the two cities that make up London, Westminster, the political capital, and the City of London, which is the financial capital, it was suffering from bombing, the Blitz. And so the whole of the London School of Economics moved to Cambridge, where at Peterhouse was empty because most of the undergraduates had gone off to the war, and so Peterhouse just moved lock, stock, and barrel. Keynes, who was among the dozen jobs that he always had simultaneously, was also the bursar of King's College, said to Hayek, "Oh, dear Friedrich, you don't want us to go to Peterhouse. It's a very minor college and rather uncomfortable. I'll make you some rooms available in King's College." And so the two of them became amazingly close as members of the senior common room together, and they ate at the high table in the rather medieval hall that King's College maintains even to this day. And they were also given the job, as everybody had to in those days, of firefighting. So we'd got this extraordinary theatrical, almost cinematic moment where both Keynes and Hayek were sat on the roof of King's Chapel, Cambridge, looking up at the skies, looking for German bombers coming overhead, and they are armed with one a shovel and one a broom in order to sweep the incendiary bombs off. It had turned out that the fire watchers who had protected buildings, historic buildings like St. Paul's Cathedral in London, had found out that actually an incendiary bomb didn't explode, it just set fire. And so if you were able to scoop it over the top of the parapet so it landed in the graveyard, then you could save the roof of an old building like that. And that's exactly what Keynes and Hayek were doing. And the interesting thing, of course, is that, I mean, of course, it was a wonderful story to start with, and it explains so much that you've allowed me to explain, to extrapolate upon. But there was also another reason, of course. They had both predicted that World War II would take place. Keynes had founded his whole reputation on an extraordinary book as a young man he wrote called The Economic Consequences of the Peace. He was a young civil servant working for the Treasury on behalf of the British government that was at the Paris peace talks that led to the Treaty of Versailles. The Treaty of Versailles was a punitive treaty. The Allies, the French, the Germans, the Italians were on one side, and on the others were the Austro-Hungarian War, for which Hayek fought as a soldier, and the Germans. And the Treaty of Versailles was to punish Germany and Austria and return it to an agrarian, instead of being, as it was, an advanced industrial society, was to turn it back to an agrarian society so that it would never again be hostile and lead to another war. But what Keynes pointed out, and what made him a hero to Hayek right from the very beginning, he pointed out that if you do that to a society, you will end up with such disenchanted people, such aggravated people, that you would lead to extreme politics, and the extreme politics would lead to extreme and very often facile solutions, the rise of the right or the left, either communism, which indeed took place with Rosa Luxemburg, or the right, which took place with Adolf Hitler, and that therefore the First World War inevitably would lead to the Second. And Hayek, in his own way, also said that. He said that if there was runaway inflation and money meant nothing, and that an economy could not maintain itself on an even keel, that would lead to exactly what Keynes had suggested. So there was a deep irony in the fact that these two men, who had fought for so long, found themselves in a common cause, watching the skies as the evidence of their prognostications flew overhead.
It's interesting that you mention Keynes's popularity in Vienna and with Hayek and the Austrians, particularly Keynes's criticism of the Versailles Treaty. Didn't that also cause Keynes some problem among his Bloomsbury friends in Great Britain because he was involved in the negotiation of that treaty?
He was indeed. Yes, one of the many interesting facets of Keynes's life was that he was a member of that extraordinary group of artists and authors, the Bloomsbury group, that formed itself just before the World War I began. Keynes was an odd man out, really, because he was a mathematician turned economist, whereas everybody else was a visual artist or a novelist or a biographer. And it should be said, by the way, that Keynes was so good at making money that he took the small amount of family money that the Bloomsbury group had, and he invested it so well that they were able to live for the whole of their lives, indulging themselves in their literary and artistic pursuits, rather than having to roll their sleeves up and make their way in a more less congenial way. Let's put it that way. But it's true that as Keynes returned home, first of all, he was, before the Treaty of Versailles, he was a treasury, a young treasury whiz, and he was the guy who borrowed money from the Americans so that the British and the French and the Italians could fight the war. It's interesting, too, there's a modern sort of shaft on this story, because the Americans then as now really didn't trust the continental Europeans to pay the money back, and so they would only lend money to Britain, who they thought was fiscally continent and would be honorable enough to pay the money back. And so Britain had to borrow the money on behalf of the French and the Italians, and all of these negotiations were done by Keynes. As the war went on, Keynes was rather fascinated by the sort of public policy aspects. Here's the first world war, as it were, you know, the very first world conflagration, and Britain was at the core of it. And how to pay for that war and how to ensure that the country continued operating as a going concern, as a business, became for him an enormous fascination. But for his liberal pacifist friends among the Bloomsbury group, what he was doing was sinful. And they made it absolutely clear. In fact, you came home one day, and there was an envelope from his friend Lytton Strachey on the dinner table. I mean, they were so close friends that they carried on living together even after they left university in a sort of commune in Bloomsbury, which the area of London which lent them their name. In this envelope was a letter saying, Maynard, isn't it about time that you gave up your support for this government? It was after a particularly heinous remark had been made by one of the cabinet ministers. And so they spent a great deal of time trying to persuade him that he shouldn't take part in the war, but he found it too interesting to give up the job. On the other hand, he did spend a great deal of time helping people to avoid conscription. So he sort of paid off his conscience, if you like, by getting people, like the members of Bloom's group, who all posed as agricultural workers in order to avoid war service. Not very honorable, I must say.
Well, would it be fair to say that perhaps Keynes came away after 1919 and into the 20s as seeing World War I as essentially successful, but that the success had been marred and almost destroyed by the conduct of the Allies, and that perhaps Hayek came away thinking that the war was a disaster and a failure and could only be mitigated in the smallest way by the actions of individuals, people saving their eggs or preserving whatever food they had or having to sell their pianos because government was impotent given the hyperinflation in Austria?
Yes, and that was really to do with the fact that they found themselves on the opposite sides of the war, and Keynes found himself with the problems of a victor and was, as a sort of generous character, anxious that the victor should do the right and honourable thing. But he was looking at it from a very lofty point of view. He was looking at it from a government point of view. He rubbed shoulders with prime ministers and presidents, you know, in Paris. He described very intimately, because he was absolutely got a front seat at the table to see Woodrow Wilson going about his business, Clemenceau going about his business, Lloyd George and so on, all of which he described in wonderfully graphic terms in his books. But yes, you're quite right, that Hayek, as a loser, found himself living in a society which had been just crippled. And so he, I think that it's inevitable that he would have thought that the only way out of this would be an individual salvation. I think it was sort of every man for himself in that society. They didn't expect government help because the government really had been broken. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was in shreds. Austria was now the head of an empire without its torso. Hungary had split off. All of the former provinces and colonies had split off, and Austria alone was being punished, and which in itself was heinous, of course. Germany and Austria between them were being blamed for everything and had to pay for everything. And I think that I suppose the alternative for Hayek would be to just leave Austria altogether, and which eventually, of course, he did by taking the opportunity of going to London. He'd worked out that there was a way of abandoning Austria and letting it sort itself out, and he would come back to it later when the dust had settled from World War I. But you're quite right. I think that he always saw life as made up of sets of choices made by individuals, and Keynes always saw things from, again, a sort of patrician point of view, from an aristocratic point of view, a way of how to administer large groups of people. They may have their individual points of view, but he was less concerned about that. He was concerned about providing conditions in which they would all prosper, whereas Hayek was always someone who was interested in how an individual could make sure that them and their own families were made comfortable.
I mean, in a way, in the larger sort of theater of Western civilization, would it be fair to talk about Keynes as essentially an inheritor of the tradition of Plato and the Guardians, and the assumption that somehow a group of people would ennoble themselves through ability and through moral rectitude and be able to guide a society, and that Hayek, on the other hand, if you had to give him a Greek antecedent, might be Sophocles or Aeschylus, in which the hero is in the dark and ultimately destroyed by forces beyond his or her control.
I think you're absolutely right, Jim, and that's a very pertinent, very perspicacious application of that comparison, I think. That's exactly how it worked. For Keynes, always it was to do with a Platonic notion, and he himself was meritocratic, but he also benefited from the company that he kept. And for him, I think it was, how could I explain this entirely? It also led, I think, to a difference between the two of them. In the broadest sense of the term, he was always an optimist. He always assumed that actually things would come right in the end, and that people should be given the benefit of the doubt. And if you did good things for people, then they would repay those good deeds with kindness and good deeds of their own. And I think that Hayek always was someone who was much more pessimistic about the role of human nature in all activity, particularly in economic activity, where they would always follow the basic tenets of what underpins all economic society, which is, on the whole, people want more rather than less. It's how a price curve works, you know. Always, I think for Hayek, it came back to that sense that the world wouldn't automatically be anything apart from nasty, brutish, and short. And I think that you could almost tell, although he had a sort of dry sense of humor, he didn't have that effortless sort of warmth and warm-heartedness that Keynes was able to express. To that extent, I think that these two ideas came out of two different psychologies, and Keynes was one sort of person, and Hayek was a different sort of person. And I think when you look today about the sort of followers who follow Keynes and those who follow Hayek, you also find that people rather line up that way. and that the pessimists tend to follow Hayek and the optimists tend to follow Keynes. And so I think, yes, your description, your classical division, I think is very clear, yes.
In terms of at least modern thinking, I guess, to generalize, the attack made on Keynes and on his ideas would in rough terms be that Keynes seemed to advocate only spending and only stimulus, regardless of what he said by way of qualification, and that at its crudest sense, the Keynesian revolution became less a philosophy than a rationalization for the political class spending whatever it wished to spend. Is that a fair criticism? Did Keynes ever say in real time and in the real world that there had been enough stimulus?
Yes, he did. Keynes went to a meeting once which had about 20 Keynesians there, and he wrote back to his wife Lydia, "Dear Lydia, I've just been with a meeting of Keynesians. I was the only non-Keynesian there." I don't think there's any doubt that the Keynesians, he died in 1946, so the world would have been very different if he'd lived even 10 years beyond that, because I think he might have put them straight on a number of things. The Keynesians, on the whole, chose the bits of, well, why not? They chose the bits of philosophy they liked, and they disregarded the bits they didn't like. What, in brief, Keynes said was that if there was a lack of demand in an economy, that it means that there was plant idle and men idle, and demand could be spurred. It could be done by either making money cheap, either by slashing taxes, or by instituting public works. But he always said that the government should never do anything that the private sector could do. In fact, the government should specifically do the things that the private sector would never get around to doing, which were very large-scale infrastructure projects and things like that. And he also said, because both Keynes and Hayek had studied during the course of the 20s the business cycle, which had led them to their theories in the first place, what Keynes said at the bottom of the cycle, when businesses went out of business and people were thrown out of work, what you should do is to infill the bottom of the curve, if you like, with demand, which only governments were in a position to be able to create. But there was an important corollary, which all Keynesians in the post-war, most Keynesians anyway in the post-war period, totally ignored. And that he said, when everybody's back to work and everybody is now prosperous again, that's when you pay off the money you borrowed at the bottom of the cycle. And I'm afraid that's exactly what was ignored. You're quite right to say that there's no doubt that there was a certain sort of government activist, a certain sort of official, that was delighted with this amazing rationalization for what they like to do, which is to spend taxpayers' money. So to that extent, Keynes was a real gift to them. On the other hand, they didn't follow his essential corollary of paying off the debt at the top of the cycle, not least because the electoral cycle and the business cycle got out of whack very quickly. And it takes a very courageous politician when all you have to do is to put your foot on the gas a little longer and defy Keynesian logic to if it means you're going to be thrown out of office. So everybody from Truman onwards has been a Keynesian of one sort or another. And you can see always when it comes up for re-election, they tend to manipulate the economy so that it's good times when it's election time. The only honorable exception of this was Dwight Eisenhower, who at the end of his second term, of course he wasn't standing for re-election, so maybe that's the reason why he was courageous, he did pay off the debt. And the result, of course, in the election of 1960 was that it was neck and neck. In fact, as we know, the election was bought by Joe Kennedy for his son, Jack Kennedy. But it was effectively neck and neck. And Richard Nixon always said, he was the candidate who took over from Eisenhower, that if only Eisenhower had been a little more Keynesian and kept his foot on the gas, he would easily have been the president in 1960 and not have to wait until the end of the decade.
Your book is interesting in large part because of some of the figures known and unknown who come into it. And I would like to sort of throw you back really to the first paragraph of the first page, or the first chapter of your book, the first page. And I'm not sure I'm pronouncing the name correctly, but Francis Isidro Edgeworth?
Edgeworth, absolutely, yeah.
Figures in this story at a number of levels. Could you expand on that a little bit?
I'm afraid that he's a forgotten economist. I'm not the person to do it. You read a sort of, if somebody's looking for a PhD thesis to do, he's a suitable case for treatment. He was the person who triggered the relationship between Keynes and Hayek at all. Hayek asked to see whether Keynes had a copy of a book by Edgeworth, Keynes wrote back saying, "I'm afraid I haven't got one. My stock is clean out." He wrote it on a postcard, evidence of the fact that Hayek knew what he was doing, and evidence of the fact that Keynes didn't know what he was doing, is that Keynes saved almost everything in his life because he knew that he was an important person. Hayek saved that very postcard that came from Keynes because he knew that Keynes was an important person. I don't think he could have guessed that he would rival Keynes in a profound way during the course of his lifetime. So that very Edgeworth request can be found today in the Hoover Institution in the Hayek collection, and it's the opening salvo, I suppose, in this whole battle. Edgeworth himself is very interesting, but I really couldn't do justice unless we had another hour, and even then I think I'd probably mislead you. He was a very complex figure who spotted very early on all sorts of things, including game theory. I mean, things that really didn't come out until right at the end of the 20th century. He anticipated in many different ways. And
he wrote in the early to mid-19th century. Is that correct?
Yes, he did. Exactly. Yes. So, I mean, he was well ahead of his time. That's why I say that he really could do with a book of his own, though I'm not sure that people would be quite as interested in him as they are in Keynes and Hayek right now.
Well, it's an interesting footnote in your book that caught my attention. The attack on Hayek, in contemporary terms, once again kind of stating the argument in the broadest possible terms, is that he was mean-spirited and that, taken at face value, his ideas would lead mostly to anarchy and unrest, sort of read either Serbia or Somalia, and that Hayek just failed to be realistic about government's role and political influence in the economy, that government is always there, no matter what we may theorize or wish, and that Hayek really did not perform as well as an analyst when he was talking about government and the economy. Is that a fair criticism of Hayek?
That's not entirely fair either, I don't think. It's certainly true to say that he didn't ever include in his let's start again. The economics argument with Keynes was only a small part of what he then went on to do. During wartime, he wrote The Road to Serfdom, which was the warning to people that if you increase the size of the government, there is a tendency towards at least the ignoring of individuals, and therefore there may well be a tendency towards tyranny. He was not absolute about it, and he wasn't even causal about it, but he set the alarms off, saying, and he was, of course, this is as the war is coming towards its end, he said that if you purge the market, as the Soviet Union had done, then what you were doing was frustrating individual freedoms at the very core of their being, it being the most natural thing for people to want to trade with each other and so on and establish real prices as opposed to socialism and or communistic view of a command economy. So what he probably should have spent some more time as he went on, he got into broader philosophical elements of his thought and looked at systems of government and so on and made various recommendations. What he didn't seem to spend as much time as people looking back on him would like him to have done, I think, is to look at sort of moral dimensions. The fact is that, sure, the market is one of the most important means whereby human beings are motivated to work, to operate, to raise their families, to get on in life. But there are also many other things, including religion and morality, which has a very small part to play in Hayek's overall view. When it comes to democracy, for instance, I mean, we know that the history of the 20th century has been, particularly as the century progressed, of people wresting themselves away from tyrannies. And they did this because of the notion of democracy and representative democracy. That's what they wanted to happen. And the problem with representative democracy, as pointed out by Hayek, is if you elect people to do things, the problem is they do things. And when they do things, it costs money. And so there is a sort of, he thought, a sort of fatal flaw in representative democracy, that it tended towards increasing the size of the state, which in itself, therefore, tended towards tyranny. So there was this paradox at the core of representative democracy. And you can see that playing out in the many arguments that's had, I mean, the Tea Party movement is the most obvious one, but many, many rational, good Republicans, conservatives, and libertarians will point this out, that it's actually the notion of representative democracy itself, which can be a danger. I think it was Rick Perry, in one of the debates, suggested that Congress should only sit 2 months a year, maybe? I mean, anyway, he was talking about really cutting back on the amount of time that they should even bother to spend looking at the things that they've been elected towards. So I think that Hayek, yes, I think that the problem with Hayek, in a way, was that when he actually found an amazing shtick. He found that he was famous for countering Keynes, and he did it in very absolute terms, saying, if you fiddle around with the economy, things will go wrong. We do not know enough about economic behavior. You Keynes, and the Keynesians, operate rather like primitive barbers when they first went into surgery. You know, they just lopped bits off without any regard to what was really happening to the body altogether. And that this ignorance would lead to terrible things, which he did predicted that stagflation would come about, rampant inflation at the same time as zero economic growth. But the having argued all that, the Keynesians won, in as much as by 1945 it was assumed that because the American economy, through borrowing, had employed all of the people who in the 1930s were unemployed, and nobody wanted to return to the 30s, that you needed to keep up a large state sector and a large amount of public spending in order to keep people employed, because no one wanted to go back to those bad old days. So inasmuch as the Keynesians therefore became the new orthodoxy, Hayek kept sort of drilling down, and he became more and more and more absolute about things. And I think probably if he'd won the argument in 1945, he might have been a little more generous about all sorts of things, and he wouldn't have been quite so black and white about things, as, by the way, Keynes pointed out to him when he read the copy of The Road to Serfdom.
On the ship voyage over to the United States.
Indeed, he was on his way to the Bretton Woods Conference. I mean, this is an example of how extraordinary Keynes was. I mean, Keynes, towards the end of the war, invented the fixed currency regime of Bretton Woods at the Bretton Woods Hotel. He invented the International Monetary Fund, which may turn out to be the very organization which is going to save Europe from its terrible financial horrors right now. And he also founded the World Bank. This was sort of almost by the way. I mean, Keynes was immensely practical, and I think, as you were saying, that Hayek wasn't very practical. In fact, Hayek really didn't like mixing with politicians. He told all of his disciples, his friends and disciples, don't go to work for a political campaign. You know, you'll get blown off course. You know, stick in a university where you can be pure.
Hayek chose to be very ambivalent, at least, to his two greatest contemporary patrons and admirers, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And he said that he was not terribly happy with what they had done, although they had tried to move in the right direction. Keynes never really insulted a politician, did he? Except
well,
perhaps Lloyd George or Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, he did in those days. Yes, Keynes was much more interested in politics as the art of the possible, and he was quite willing to, as he said famously, when circumstances change, I change my views. And what do you do, sir? As if to imply that someone who, you know, stood by his ground, as Hayek always did, was somehow missing out on the ebb and flow of arguments, or the ebb and flow really of opportunities to get things done and things achieved. Keynes was always looking for ways that he could take advantage of other people's movements, their ignorance, their misapprehensions, in order to step into the void and provide such a cogent explanation that they would follow what he was saying. Hayek wasn't interested in that at all. There's a very touching quote where he says, you know, it would have been much easier for me, really, if I'd fallen in with all of this Keynesian mm-hmm. stuff and all this socialism. And then, of course, I would be known as, you know, a good pragmatic fellow, and I'd be fine. But then, of course, I wouldn't be me. The fact is that I'm known as a sort of a contrarian, a maverick, a difficult fellow. But, of course, it's because he stood his ground that now he has been elevated on a pedestal alongside Keynes. I mean, he is the anti-Keynes. And those two different views, I must say, I don't think I'm thanked by Keynesians very much for elevating Hayek, but it's the truth of the matter. Hayek actually came out with a very cogent range of opinions and notions, which just called a halt to Keynes and said, hold on a minute, before you go any further, you're going to mess things up. And
Let's see if we can restore your stock with the Keynesians, and bearing in mind that Keynes died in 1946, so we can't know these things for sure. Nonetheless, a couple of contemporary questions seem almost inescapable. Here in Washington, D.C., the federal government currently borrows about 40 cents of every dollar. If Keynes were alive today, get out your Ouija board. If you think that this could be imagined, would Keynes consider that enough stimulus, enough borrowing? And if not, how much further or how much less would Keynes have wished to go?
Well, as I explained a little earlier, there were three different ways that Keynes would have made suggestions, and the one which is normally not ascribed to him is usually ascribed to Hayek, though Hayek was quite the opposite, in fact, is cutting taxes. I think that Keynes, if he thought that the borrowing was just too high and that borrowing even more was politically out of order, then I think that he would say, in which case there's another way of borrowing effectively, and that is to just not tax people, not tax businesses, and wait until the economy recovers from a sort of supply-sidey way, in a way, and then that would be fine.
On the other hand,
of course, I think we'd also say that if the whole world is borrowing and if the whole world is in debt, everybody is sort of plummeting at the same speed towards what is effectively a bottomless pit. We go down and down and down, but actually that's where tomorrow can be found. We all head towards the same place, and so as long as you don't get caught out being out of step with everybody else's borrowing, as Greece and Italy and Portugal and Ireland were, where they borrowed far, far, way beyond what it would be sensible to do, I don't think that, for instance, there's any thought that genuinely the American economy is going to, or the American government is going to renege on its debts. I can't see that on the cards at all. So would he say borrow more? Probably in the short term he might well say borrow more. The difficulty about selling that today is, of course, that people just know a little more about things. And not least thanks to Hayek, they are armed with arguments which point out that this is a dangerous way forward. The thing, though, is that for Keynes, Keynes pointed out that macroeconomics, a way of understanding economics from above, that the government had responsibilities and the operation of economics is very different from the operation of business, which in its own way is also very different from the operation of the household budget. And what the arguments against Keynes have tended to do is to say, in the middle of a recession, it's a bad idea to do anything else apart from to pay down your credit card debt and pay off your own debts and start saving for the rainy day, which may well come tomorrow. And that, of course, is, from Keynes's point of view, all very laudable, but actually not very sensible when it comes to a national economy, which doesn't actually have to pay down its debts at the speed with which, say, the British government is paying down its debts at the moment. What he would suggest, which is exactly what seems to be about to happen, by raising taxes against Keynesian notions, by paying off debt at the bottom of the cycle against Keynesian notions, you would invite a double-dip recession, and that's exactly where Britain seems to be heading right now.
A sort of corollary question. How would Keynes respond to the role of central banks, and particularly the American Federal Reserve, in terms of the amount of money pumped into the world economy and the national economy, and also in terms of at least a certain hint of anti-democratic sentiments when you look at how the Fed here in the United States is structured and appointed and operates. Would Keynes have imagined that a central bank would have grown to the size and scope, apparently, of the Federal Reserve in the 2007-2008 period?
Well, I think he might, because he always rather liked those grand institutions, not least those that weren't particularly democratic, if what you were doing was the right thing and the democratic alternative would stop you doing the right thing. So I think that he would find Ben Bernanke a laudable figure. His views, as we know, about the IMF and the World Bank set up exactly that sort of institution, though it was also true to say that his biggest fights were with the Independent Bank of England, which was very much like Bernanke. It's just that it had a different view in those days, or the central bankers had a different view in those days. Right now, they seem to be an arm of government that wants to do something, even if it will lead to inflation, which is what printing money will lead to. Of course, a great remark always when people like Hayek pointed out that inflation might work and stimuluses might work in the short, medium term, but they would cause inflation. But they might put some people back to work, but it would all go wrong in the medium to long term. And Keynes always would say, of course, in the long term, we're all dead. He was just interested in getting the show back on the road. So I think probably he would imagine Bernanke's was a good idea. Hayek's solution was a rather radical one, and one that actually in practice in the past in America didn't work terribly well. What Hayek wanted was there to be no federal bank. I mean, it's true to say that if you really can't have a true free market economy if the government owns the currency and fixes interest rates. Because, after all, that's the key thing in an economy, exactly where you set that interest rate. It's like the setting a path on a compass. It's absolutely pointing towards the scale of the economy and the size of the economy and who may be hurt or will benefit from an economy. So Hayek thought that it would be much better to put to do without the central bank altogether and to have private companies issuing currencies separately, as they did before the Civil War here, and that the companies that had a sound money would do well, and those who had printed too much money would do badly as people flew from them into safer and harder currencies. Right at the moment, of course, it's rather peculiar on the world stage, because as much as in America we tend to think that the Federal Reserve is doing too much quantitative easing and is taking measures which would lead to inflation eventually, at the same time, there is a flight of money into America because no one believes that the American government will renege on its debts. So we have actually a relatively strong dollar. We have a relatively strong pound because they have a fiscally conservative
the worse
policy.
They look, the better we do.
Yeah, exactly. And the Swiss franc, of course, I mean, they have the upside-down problem with Bernanke. They have so much money flooding in that nobody can buy any Swiss goods because the price of the currency is so high. And so what they're trying to do is to do the opposite of, and they are inviting inflation. They really want inflation in order to reduce their currency. But the whole euro drama is, I think it's testing us and testing all of our notions way beyond anything that we have thought about probably since probably the early 30s when everything was, going to hell in a handbasket.
Milton Friedman emerges as a central figure, a subsidiary one, but a central figure in your book. Why is he so important in your view?
When Keynes died, Hayek said to his wife 2 weeks ago, there were two men who were the most famous economists in the world, John Maynard Keynes and me. Now Maynard is dead, and he has been risen, lifted to sainthood, and I have become a derisory figure, thanks mainly to writing The Road to Serfdom. And he was, there's no doubt, totally ignored. He was ignored, more or less, on and off until the mid-70s. But he wouldn't give up. It's part of the wonders of his character that the more people ignored him, the more people disliked him, even though, by the way, he did end up with terrible mental troubles later on. I think the isolation finally got to him. But he, in a way, the fact that he was ignored to him proved that he must be on the right track. And so he brought together a group of totally disparate conservatives and libertarians to meet in a, literally in a summit, that is to the Mont Pelerin Hotel, which is in the Swiss Alps, and he brought them all together, including Milton Friedman. And he said to them, first of all, don't get it mixed up in politics. What we need to do is provide, like Keynes did in the general theory, we need to provide a definitive explanation for why our ideas make sense. And eventually, through the universities, these ideas will filter down to the politicians and they'll get picked up, as indeed they did eventually by Reagan and Thatcher and others. But Milton Friedman, who really had been invited by accident, he was invited really just to sort of to add to a sort of fourth in bridge.
A coincidence of marriage.
By a coincidence of marriage, exactly, because he was an undergraduate at the University of Chicago, and because they allocated the seats in alphabetical order, he was sat next to a woman who turned out to be one of the great Chicago economist sisters, and he'd been invited by Hayek, and so he went along as if for the ride. But he got on very well with Hayek. It also should be said, but it's true, by the way, that Milton Friedman went to Cambridge, and he got on very well with the Keynesians, too. He was a very amenable fellow, but he had, rather like Hayek, he had the ability to sort of stick his head into the oncoming wind, and he was able to persistently say that other people were talking nonsense when he thought they were talking nonsense. And he... although he didn't follow Hayek's economics, in fact, he thought that Hayek's economics made no sense, but he did admit or agree, I should say that, the agree with the road to serfdom's notion that the larger the state is, the more likely that people will, elected officials will waste taxpayers' money. And also there would be risk to individual freedoms, and he certainly believed that. But he amended Keynesianism in a very smart way. What he said was that instead of allowing governments to print money when they needed it in order to boost prosperity, even though the result would be inflation, that what you should do is to just allow a small increase in money supply to year on year take place, and therefore you keep inflation under control, but at the same time you maintain an equilibrium, more or less. There will be ups and downs, but the very worst of the bottom of a recession would have gone, and there would be a corollary of the most irrational, as it were, exuberance at the very top of the business cycle would also go. But to stay on an even keel, if the central bank just eked out the money supply, then you could take control of inflation, and you could also improve economic growth. And actually, the very first president who took up Friedman on his ideas wasn't Richard Nixon, who he worked for and who he had very little time for, and certainly Nixon, who declared himself a Keynesian, had very little time actually for Friedman because he wasn't political enough. He kept suggesting things which would lose him votes. The person who actually chose a monetarist, a Friedmanite, for the first time was, of all people, Jimmy Carter, someone who was roundly punished by Ronald Reagan when he produced an economy which was worse off than when he'd inherited it. And the central banker who, and here's maybe an example of where the central bank can work immensely responsibly if you want, Paul Volcker, who was the chairman of the Federal Reserve, introduced monetarism. It was immensely painful. But it did purge inflation from the system, and it got the American economy to start growing again, and it has more or less until recent times grown ever since, thanks to do with that continence of money. So, yes, Milton Friedman is one of the giants. Must have been very irritating for Hayek that Milton Friedman won his Nobel Prize a year before Hayek won his Nobel Prize. You know, it's a bit like, I don't know, your son coming in first and you coming in second, yeah, in the school relay. But anyway, fascinating figure, Friedman. And again, many of these stories, I try not to take too many sides. I think that it's better for a reader to come to their own conclusions, not least when they arrive, they start off with certain conclusions. I'm interested in seeing how, when you present a story to people, they might end up with a slightly different opinion when they finish reading the book. It's not really up to me to tell people how to think. That's somebody else's job. But I think that Friedman, for instance, and Hayek, for that matter, have been treated to mostly hagiographic biographies. and I don't think it's done them any favors. The fact is that there is probably a very good biography of Friedman to be written, which is slightly more even-handed and less laudatory, and it would also bring out just the warmth of character that he had and what a fine man he was.
You quote John Kenneth Galbraith often in the book. Did you find that Galbraith added substantially or substantively to the Keynesian sort of economics, or was he more of a publicist for Keynes here in the United States?
Yeah, he was like Paul Samuelson, I think. He was just the high priest of Keynes, and I think Samuelson did add some bits and pieces. But what they did most of all was to spread the word. And Galbraith was, as we know, a silver-tongued, eloquent, drawling fellow, hugely. I don't know whether you ever met him, but I met him a number of times when I was briefly at Harvard. And he was highly entertaining all the time. And it's very difficult when you're describing something going on not to just add a little quote from Galbraith. He is so eminently quotable and so funny. But at the same time, he actually cuts through the nonsense. When it comes to Reagan, for instance, you know, people today, I still hear that Ronald Reagan, you know, yes, he slashed taxes and he did this, that, and the other. Well, actually, he put up taxes a lot. And the reason that we were so well off was actually he was also a very good Keynesian. The reason that so much money was being spent in the public sector was in order to put an end to the Cold War, for which we're all grateful. It was a great act and a great act of determination. But the happy side product for Reagan, anyway, was that actually there were money was being hosed right and left into the American economy, and everybody was feeling very prosperous and very well and very happy. So that's what Galbraith was capable of doing, pricking the bubbles of his opponents. He wasn't a very good Keynesian in some respects. He didn't, for instance, believe in cutting taxes any more than Hayek believed in cutting taxes. That was Keynes's notion, and he said that it was like, let's see if I can get this right, that it was like it was like a horse eating seeds. You know, it would eventually come out in a pile of manure at the other end, but actually it wouldn't particularly help the horse. Well, that's not the
all right.
Exactly. I suppose people who keep roses might be interested in that story. But the for Hayek thought the same thing too. Hayek didn't agree with Reagan. I mean, Reagan was a leap of faith, and it was very Keynesian. By the way, it should be remembered that although it was pre-Keynesian, that Reagan read economics. He was an economics BA. And he always maintained an interest in economics. He was always dismissed as if he was a silly Hollywood B actor or something. Not at all. He actually read insatiably. He was someone who, because he disliked flying, he was frightened of flying, actually. It meant that when he was employed by General Electric to go and give pep talks to the workers at its plants, he would go always by train. So he read insatiably, and he read serious books, including Hayek. And so that's an interesting byproduct. The Samuelson, I think, probably did a little more. But what Samuelson should not, I mean, retrospectively, be forgiven for is that, and almost all the Keynesians do this, and that is that they totally diminish Hayek's role. The fact was that, in retrospect, we can see that Hayek actually was a major figure, and that he did defy Keynes, and he tested Keynes, and he pushed Keynes, and he forced the Keynesians to confront something which was real. And yet Samuelson, in his great economics textbook, which anyone of a certain age will have been taught by, wholly Keynesian, the word Hayek barely appears. In Robert Skibelsky's mammoth, magisterial, three-volume biography of Keynes, Hayek barely gets a look in, you know, maybe half a dozen mentions throughout. Roy Harrod, the original biographer of Keynes, was actually much more generous to Hayek because he did realize that he was an important person. On the other hand, he still doesn't get very much of a look in. So that's why I say that the Keynesians, who are used to having the whole thing going their own way, don't necessarily grab my book. What they say is, why is the other guy's name on here?
On a technical point, I noticed reading your book, and by the way, I am of that certain age where Samuelson was gospel in my undergraduate years. Did you ever consider providing inflation-adjusted figures for the numbers of dollars and pounds in the 1920s and the 1930s. Those numbers look almost yawningly puny by today's standards, but actually it was real money in those days.
It absolutely was. The trouble is that if you get into that, it's not as easy as you might. There is actually even a program on Google that allows you to put a $1920 dollar into a, 2010 terms. I didn't know the reasoning behind coming to those conclusions. And in any case, although, yes, they do look puny, it's only the comparative of the time figures that we're talking about. So I think that within the context, they make some sort of sense. The difficulty about making them into the real figures is that the real figures are so vast that that, too, is incomprehensible. I mean, I don't know about you, but I can barely understand anything beyond about $150. I mean, when it gets big, we're talking, there was a report out today that said $7.7 trillion had been pumped into the economy by Bernanke. Everybody had a fit when Obama put $1 billion in, $1 trillion in, and now we're talking about $7.7 trillion. I mean, really, my head is spinning. I've got no idea whether this, I mean, I know it's a vast figure, but, after vast, where do you go? I mean, you get into superlatives, don't you? And I think that within the context, people get the gist, that at the time it was a lot of money, and beyond a lot of money, I'm not quite sure how anybody really gets to grasp it. People bandy around vast figures, but there are very few people who actually understand exactly the difference between one vast figure and the next.
So you have faith in the reader.
Always, of course. I mean, I wouldn't have written a story about what is effectively an immensely dry subject, but it's aimed at people who can take a leap of faith along with me and just believe me when I tell you that this was revolutionary, that this was shocking or whatever that it was. And yes, of course, you have to do that. Otherwise, you pander, and I can't be bothered with that.
Well, since this is a Federalist Society podcast and the practice group is professional responsibility and legal education, I must ask, toward the end at least, do you believe your book should be required reading in American law schools for American law students? And if so, what are your top three reasons for thinking that?
That's an interesting question. I mean, far be it from me to recommend anything. I mean, although I'm an American, I'm still far too English to say that they should read anything. On the other hand, I think that there is a truth to be found in reading this story, and it's not just the truth of the fact that there was another person who wasn't Keynes, who came up with a totally plausible explanation for why Keynesianism was wrong. It's also worth reading it in order to understand Keynes better, because Keynes was a wonderful person that anyone might want to read or meet, even on the printed page. He was a glorious figure in all respects, and he certainly made... I liked writing about Hayek, but I always loved writing about Keynes, because he's that sort of character. The broader lessons about the role of law in society, I think, is important, in as much as Friedrich Hayek quite rightly pointed out that it is essential in a modern capitalist society, if it is to be a proper good civilization, that you should always have the rule of law. And that is a key thing that anyone studying law should know. I mean, the rule of law should mean what it says. And he came out of a tradition having had his country occupied by people who took no concern about the rule of law. And I'm often asked about China and its booming economy and so on. I think they're going to run into trouble as soon as the Chinese people work out that actually materialism is not everything, that there are very important things to do with the way their society is run, and it must be founded upon the rule of law. And that basic principle, which started in the Magna Carta probably, it's a very well-established one in the English-speaking world, has taken a lot of time to take root in other places. And Hayek's reminder that it was the rule of law which was the key to personal freedoms, I think, was something which is well worth celebrating. So did I give you three there? Probably not.
Well, I wanted to close by saying that I am a conversationalist, and sometimes the weakness of a conversationalist is overlooking important things and in pursuing other important things. Are there other aspects of your book that you would particularly commend that we may not have covered? And if not, I will turn the phone over to David Ray, who I think has some disclaimers and fine print to read.
Okay. I think that there are some things. For instance, we now know that Keynes and Hayek fought like cat and dog. I mean, they fought, apparently, according to one of the professors who watched on in horror, that they fought like Kilkenny cats. Though why Irish cats are particularly vicious, I don't know. But anyway, they did fight. But interestingly, in wartime, when there was an existential threat, Friedrich Hayek, who loved living in England, who had become an honorary Englishman, and even when he lived in America, he harked back on the days that he lived in England, and particularly the days that he shared in Cambridge with Maynard Keynes. I think that, interestingly, these two men did work together when there was an existential threat to their country. And they worked together on trying to work out whether there should be a system of rationing or whether there should be a system of price controls, whether money should be set aside, as they both agreed, toward the post-war world, so that you might tax somebody, but you would put that money in trust for them and give it back to them when the war was finished, so that the post-war world would not suffer from the indignities and poverty of the immediate World War I world. So I would say to anybody who takes violent side, Keynesian or Hayekian, that actually these two men did work together when it came to it. And if we think that at the moment we're reaching an existential threat, maybe it's also time that we worked a little closer together. It's also true to say, of course, which so just to completely confine what I just said, that in the 1930s, when we were in very similar circumstances to today, they disagreed. That's when they actually disagreed. It's a matter of whether the existential threat to Western civilization is about to be reached. If the Eurozone collapses, and if all sorts of horrors therefore entail, Mrs. Merkel is talking about civil unrest on a vast scale not seen for nearly 100 years. I mean, if those sorts of things happen, if the Euro debt crisis draws in the American economy, if what the anger, the evident anger and distaste for what's going on in Washington, to be seen in the Tea Party and the Occupy Wall Street movement, turns sour, even sourer, and people take to the streets or whatever, I don't want to be too apocalyptic about this, then it may be too late to get together. It strikes me that we're at the 11th hour as it is. Things are going terribly wrong in our society, with no prospect in the near or medium future of us being anything else apart from a society which has 14 million people unemployed, which in some sections of the community, of course, means one in four unemployed. African Americans, women, all sorts of different groups have much higher proportions of unemployed than others. And if that all led to unrest on a large scale, then we too could become victim to the sorts of tin pot dictators and plausible jokers that that led us into World War II. So on that unhappy note, I think probably that's where I'd leave it.
So the civility and the mutual respect and recognition of each other's positions that Keynes and Hayek shared is perhaps the thing that you would most emphasize as being a theme of your book.
I think so. I think that's the takeout thing, that you can be as violently opposed to somebody's argument as you like, but actually at the end of the day, you've got to live together, and live together in the same house very often, in which case, we all know this, any married person knows this, you must not go to bed with a quarrel still simmering that might reemerge in the morning, and it makes no sense that right now for the two sides not to talk to each other and to just slam the door in each other's faces. That is not the way that we will get out of this mess.
Well, in the spirit of civility and sharing, I am going to turn the phone over to David Ray, but I thank you very much for your participation and for this conversation.
Thank you, Jim.
And I do want to thank both you, Mr. Wapshot, and you, Mr. Haynes, for participating today, and thanks to our audience for listening. We hope that you've enjoyed this Practice Group podcast, and for materials related to this podcast and any other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia. Thank you again.